This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Today we're marking the 50th anniversary of the passing of John Charles McQuaid, Archbishop of Dublin from 1940 to 1972. A colossus of the Catholic Church in his day, he is famous or infamous for his opposition to Health Minister Noel Brown's Mother and Child Scheme in 1951. Less well known is his pioneering work on Irish emigrant welfare in Britain and his influence on the architecture and planning of Dublin. Now, to discuss these and related matters, I'm joined by independent social researcher Brian Harvey, journalist Mary Kenny, author of The Way We Were, Catholic Ireland since 1922, published by Columba Books in 2022. That'll be reviewed in the next issue of History Ireland, incidentally. Journalist and broadcaster David McCullough, biographer of Eamon de Valera. And finally, architectural historian Ellen Rowley, who's a lecturer in modern Irish architecture at UCD's School of Architecture. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the National Library of Ireland. Okay, now to get us started, Mary, in your piece in the current issue of History Ireland on John Charles McQuaid, you talk about the importance of his background. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, yes. Of course, I am a Dubliner and I grew up in the shadow, if you like, of John Charles McQuaid as he was Archbishop of Dublin. And in many ways, he wasn't at all a suitable Archbishop of Dublin, we felt. But nevertheless, he did, as we will show, have enormous power. What was important about John Charles, I think, was that he was born in Cavan in Coot Hill. And even more important, perhaps, in the first few weeks of his life, his mother died. He was born in 1895. And his father was a very respected doctor, Eugene McQuaid, was described as one of the most distinguished medical practitioners, you know, who known in Cavan. As many other members of his family were also doctors. So he had, from the beginning, he had a great interest in health. I mean, his sister, Helen, was actually a doctor of venereal diseases, which was in that time very pioneering since it was stigmatized both in Britain, where she worked, and Ireland. And this led to John Charles actually opening a clinic in Dublin for sexually transmitted diseases, which was considered very progressive, actually, at the time, one of his quixotic progressive parts. But Cavan, you know, he did inherit, as John Cooney in his biography has pointed out, he did inherit in Cavan somewhat, if you like, a sectarian mindset, because it was a border county which was very contested, and there were bitter historical feelings, if you like, between Catholics and Protestants. And he carried this hostility to Protestants forward in his career. But I think very influential was the death of his mother, and his mother Jane, who was apparently a very cultivated and a religious person. She must have died of purple fever, which was very not very common, but which did occur, which did was something that women died from, alas, in just after childbirth. And within a year, Dr. Eugene married again, and he had four more children. He also had he also adopted some little cousins who were orphans. So it was quite a big family home and a very cultivated family home. And his stepmother Agnes seems to have been also a very cultured person. But crucially, John Charles didn't learn that his stepmother wasn't his birth mother until he was 16 years of age. So I think that was profoundly formative for him. He had a very, very highly idealized view of motherhood, which he called the divine motherhood. And I think that very often those who lose their mothers do have that very, very strong feeling of idealization. So these were the formative influences in his life.
Can I just cut across there, Mary? So you're telling me then he didn't become aware that his stepmother wasn't his real mother until he was a teenager. Is that correct?
He wasn't. I'm not under six. I don't always use the word real mother because.
Oh, sorry. Sorry if that slipped. His biological mother, if you like.
Because she was, like many adoptive mothers, she was a good mother to him. And she did treat him as a mother. And as a mother would. So he wasn't deprived of mother love in that sense, but it was a trauma for him to discover that she wasn't his birth mother. So I think that was, as I say, quite formative in his life. He was sent to St. Patrick's School, which apparently didn't like very much, and then he was sent on to Black Rock, and finally he went to Clongowes. And Black Rock was very important in his life. He was very clever from the beginning. He you know, got really academically very bright and won a lot of, you know, classics prizes and so on as he progressed. And at the age of 18, he decided to enter the Holy Ghost novitiate, which is, of course, we now call the Spiritans, I think, and was, of course, a missionary order. And Black Rock College would be a very important aspect and element in his life. I mean, looking forward to his life, you know, there are two John Charles McQuaids, really. There is the man up to 1940, I think, where he became dean and then president of Black Rock College, where he was greatly liked, actually. I mean, he taught people like Brian O'Nolan, who became Miles Nagopoline as well, Miles Nagopoline's brother, Ciarán, remembered John Charles McQuaid as very friendly and sociable and again, very cultured. And so people like Brendan O'Regan of Shannon Airport, they were devoted to him. They said he was wonderful and that he was very enlightened. And people like Elizabeth Bowen, who was, of course, after all, a British spy and didn't have a very high opinion of Irish Catholics generally. She was absolutely beguiled by him and thought he was a true intellectual, a true European, a man who spoke French and Italian. Of course, he had studied in Rome and was very influenced, incidentally, by French spirituality at many levels. So that until he gained power, it seemed, he's often described as a serious and cultured person and a popular teacher, quite firm but fair. It was really, it seems to me, when he gained power that he began to change into the very domineering control freak that he became.
We'll come back to that, Mary. Just one point, by the way. Now, the Holy Ghost Fathers are a missionary order, right? So how come John Charles didn't go on the missions?
Yes, it's interesting because he was influenced indeed by a charismatic, rather religious extremist priest in Black Rock called Brother Gaspard. But and it was his intention, but at each time that he was sort of due to go on the missions, life kind of interrupted the decision, and he was appointed, first of all, the Dean of Studies at Black Rock, and that interrupted his idea of going on the missions. And then secondly, of course, he became Archbishop of Dublin. So other choices just came along. And according to him, he sort of followed God's will in this matter. And so that would have been his account. So he became instead, really, if you like, the ruler of Catholic Ireland.
Now, he ends up, as you said, Dean and then President of Black Rock College. And that's, of course, where his life intersects with Aimé de Valera. David, can I bring you in there? Because, of course, Dev was a product of Black Rock College. So what's the origin then of his link-up with John Charles McQuaid?
Well, Dev wasn't just a product of Blackrock College. He was kind of obsessed with Blackrock College all the way through his life. And he was assiduous attender of events there, and he would have met McQuaid through that. And also through the fact that his sons went to Blackrock College, so McQuaid would have been involved in their education. So there would have been the normal sort of parent-teacher relationship there. But also McQuaid clearly could recognise that De Valera was a useful person to know and a useful person to have the ear of. And McQuaid could be useful to De Valera at times as well. During the Eucharistic Congress, there was a garden party in Blackrock College, in the grounds of Blackrock College. And De Valera was facing a bit of a potential diplomatic incident because he was in dispute, as you'll know, with the Governor General, James McNeill, at the time. And McQuaid very helpfully arranged separate rooms where each could meet the papal legate so they wouldn't have an embarrassing meeting together. So that's just an indication of the fact that McQuaid was prepared to be useful to people in power. And when he had De Valera's ear, I came across some very interesting letters from McQuaid to De Valera in 1934. So this is before the drafting of the Constitution. And it's McQuaid very concerned that Protestant medical interests were taking control of children's health in Dublin. And this goes back to the point that Mary was raising about his kind of sectarian attitude. Really didn't like Protestants, and particularly didn't like Protestants taking over medical control, medical power. So that goes back presumably to his father. And he refers to the Protestants as the other side. He talks about handing over the Catholic children to an almost exclusively non-Catholic medical control and how this would be a bad thing. The interesting thing is he obviously assumes that Eamon de Valera has a similar distrust of, suspicion of, dislike of Protestants as he did himself. And that actually wasn't the case, as he was to find out during the drafting of the Constitution.
Tell me this, David. I mean, has his influence on the drafting of the Constitution been exaggerated? Because there's different schools of thought on this.
It has a bit. I mean, he certainly contributed, and he contributed in ways that De Valera approved of. And De Valera said in later life that the bits that McQuaid suggested had never caused any controversy, whereas when De Valera went against his advice, he found himself in trouble. McQuaid was one of a number of clerics who were feeding papal encyclicals, the latest in Catholic social thought, into the drafting process. Two areas in particular, I think, that the status of women and also the place of religion are important. So the article about the place of women is based on papal encyclicals. Rerum Novarum states that a woman is by nature fitted for homework. And one of De Valera's other clerical advisor, the Jesuit Edward Cahill, proposed an article stating that it was God's will that the husband and father should be the breadwinner while the wife and mother is mistress of the home. Now, McQuaid came up with a slightly less extreme version, saying the state should recognise that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state support with which the common good can be achieved. So De Valera changed it slightly and added the bit about the state trying to make sure that women aren't forced to work outside the home. So De Valera used McQuaid's advice, and McQuaid was very strong in advising him when there was an uproar about this, with feminists feeling that this was discriminatory. Of course, it's still controversial today. And McQuaid at one point writes to De Valera, "The feminists are getting angry and are moving into action. They seem stung by the suggestion that the normal place for a woman is the home." So he's advising De Valera to hold fast, which, of course, De Valera does. And De Valera is completely at a loss as to why anybody would think that there was anything wrong with this. He really couldn't understand the opposition. So they were ad idem on that. Where they weren't ad idem was on the question of what recognition should be given to the Catholic Church in the Constitution. And McQuaid was very, very strong, strongly of the view that the Constitution should recognise the Roman Catholic Church as the one true church. And De Valera was tempted by this. He felt it might be his duty as a Catholic to follow this through. But eventually he concluded that for political reasons, it would be absolutely impossible to do this. So he came up with the compromise of recognizing the special position of the Catholic Church as the church of the majority of the population. Subsequently criticized as being too Catholic, if you like, too deferential to the church, criticized at the time because it wasn't deferential enough. And McQuaid in particular was extremely annoyed by this, extremely disappointed by what De Valera had done, to the extent that they actually had had an argument about it. And McQuaid later writes to apologise and says he's sorry if his disappointment led him to go overboard, and hoping that De Valera would continue to consult him. So that's 1937 or thereabouts. McQuaid is still in Blackrock College. He hasn't yet become Archbishop. He's still deferential to De Valera. And that all changes when McQuaid becomes Archbishop. And this links into another point Mary was making about the change in his character when he becomes Archbishop. Because
just going back to the before he becomes Archbishop, I mean, was it Deb that made him Archbishop?
I mean, Deb certainly helped. I mean, the Department of External Affairs and the mission to the Vatican were encouraging the Vatican to pick McQuaid. De Valera had discussed it with the Papal Nuncio, Pascal Robinson, who had come up with the idea on his own. So they were working in tandem, if you like. And the reason that they were supporting McQuaid was that he was regarded as a very efficient person. They'd seen his achievements in Blackrock as chairman of the Headmasters Association. They knew he was a man who could do business, and the Archdiocese was very much in need of an able and efficient administrator, and he was regarded as that. So once he becomes,
how unusual was it? I mean, he was a member of a religious order, right? The Holy Ghost Fathers of Spirit, as they're now called. I mean, that's very unusual. I mean, presumably there was a lot of people amongst the diocesan clergy with their noses out of joint
They
were passed over.
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of the problem was his predecessor, Archbishop Byrne, had been ill for a long time, and the firm government had been taken off the archdiocese, and a lot of the diocesan clergy, there was a lot of factionalism different groups forming, and therefore I think it was felt that somebody from outside the diocesan clergy might be wouldn't be seen as associated with any of the main groups, and therefore would be better able to bring about unity, and he certainly, whatever one thinks of it, he certainly managed to do that.
Okay, I want to bring in Brian Harvey here, right? Okay, we've got up to the point where John Charles has now been installed as the Archbishop of Dublin. So, Brian, what was the state of the Dublin Archdiocese when he took it over? I mean, David has alluded to his predecessor here.
I think we should remember that the early Irish Free State had a very parsimonious social policy. During the first 20 years of the Free State, there were very few new social services or social provision set up. We didn't actually get a minister for social welfare until 1947. When Archbishop McQuaid came into office, he found that not only were social services underdeveloped, but that they'd been very much exacerbated by wartime hardship. He did try to persuade government to set up and fund social services, but came very quickly to the conclusion that this was not going to happen. So he moved very fast to organise this himself. First of all, he brought in a new institutional structure called the Catholic Social Service Conference, which indeed persists to the present day, though it's now known as Crosscare. He expanded the services enormously. He set up food centres before the term food poverty had been invented. He set up fuel supplies for people who had difficulty acquiring or paying for fuel in the days before the terms fuel poverty had been invented. He provided a lot of immediate cash relief for people at a time when there was no such social welfare system. We didn't get that till the 1970s. He set up housing services. He helped to initiate services for Irish emigrants in Britain. Most of the commentary on what McQuaid did has tended to focus on the volume of the work that he did. And that was enormous, because he bullied parish priests, the religious orders, even though he had no institutional authority over them, to set up services. He did have his own stream of cash flow, which came from diocesan funds, and he poured a lot of that into social services. So in the 1940s, during the worst period of the war, you saw a huge expansion of what would now be called proximity social services that people could access relatively easily. But I think if we just look at the volume of these services, we will probably miss some of the important points about what he did. it was certainly true that he did this in a very top-down command and control approach. But there was a great sense of urgency. Indeed, if Irish social services had been set up with a similar sense of urgency, they might have got a lot further sooner. He invested a lot in structures. For him, structures, institutions mattered. Administration mattered. John Cooney, his biographer, described him as a superb administrator. And the record is there in the 700 boxes of files that he left behind. He believed very much on helping the most excluded, the very poorest of the poor, people who were neglected, young boys and girls in trouble with the law. For example, profound disability, children who were deaf-blind, he had services for them. One of his pet projects, and indeed a controversial one because it clashed with Protestant provision, was the idea of a children's hospital. But he wanted the best equipment for that. For him, nothing else would do. He had the idea of joined-up services, that you didn't just turn up at a place looking for cash. He believed that people should be provided if they needed it, and this was particularly true of emigration services. People needed not just cash, they needed accommodation, they needed work. And he tried to provide all of those services under one roof. Later on in his career as Archbishop, he moved into such new areas as drugs and adult education and making provision there. So in terms of social policy, and leaving aside the many other aspects of his work, which were not so progressive, he was far ahead of his time.
Frank, I just come in there, right? Because just what you've outlined there, I'm thinking this is a program that James Connolly himself would have been proud of, right? I mean, this is a socialist, it's the only word that strikes me, program.
I think there's an important difference. He was very much in favor of such services. When he was involved in them, he did not believe, I don't think, that people should organize these services for themselves. He was not a collectivist. And indeed, we know that he disputed, for example, the Unemployed Workers Association. I don't think he was into that kind of collective activity or collective approach by people who were poor. It was very much a giving out of services.
So although he did that well. From the top down, you're saying.
It was top down, but I think it should be added that what he was doing was very much in line with continental European social practice. You saw similar practices in the more Catholic European countries like Belgium, like France, particularly Spain and Portugal and Italy. It was very much in that tradition of Catholic social service provision, which was accepted as the norm across Europe, maybe not so much in some of the Scandinavian states. But he was the Irish example that he set was not an outlier. But I think the point I would make is that the professionalism with which it was done was very much before his time. And one of his legacies, I think, was that from this emerged many, many years later, the advocacy groups that came to challenge government social policy, but from the left instead. This was the Conference of Major Religious Superiors, Social Justice Ireland. They are the linear descendants of what he set up, albeit from a somewhat different point of the ideological spectrum.
No, I want to bring Ellen in here, Ellen Rowley, because at this stage, I mean, Dublin is a city which is essentially confined within the canals, but it's about to undergo a huge expansion in the 50s, 60s. And of course, John Charles had a hand in that as well. So Ellen, just outline the sort of impact he had on the subsequent planning of Dublin.
Okay, so thanks, Tommy. So in terms of that point of him being a socialist despite himself, that's a comment that we make in a recent film about the demolition of the church, Finglas West Church, the Nunciation, because he had such an extreme interest in what he called workers' parishes, that we were trying to understand how these buildings were paid for. So who was paying for them and what he was trying to do to mobilize parishes to be somehow self-sufficient and to make these monumental architectures. So I suppose the first reason that I began to look at this line of inquiry within a history of architecture of that period and coming to him was because of the extent of churches built. So following the built evidence, and there are a remarkable amount of these buildings that were being built on the edges of the city. So what we're seeing is this period of a kind of extreme or significant Catholic expansion. And you know, for the first 25 years of his reign, might we say, from 1940 to 65, he oversees the construction of 34 new churches. Now, these are vast things, Tommy. These are capable of holding, you know, on average 1,500 people. At the same time, he has this sacred commission, or rather, these advisors who are helping him divvy up parish lands. And so these are three or four trusted priests: Monsignor Fitzpatrick, Cecil Barrett, Father O'Reilly, and Canon McArdle. And they're all working on different areas, say to the north of the city, around Raheny, Artane, later Coolock, and then to the west of the city around Crumlin, Drimna, later Ballyfermot, Walkinstown. And what they're doing is they're apportioning land, they're creating these boundaries and borders, and during that 25-year period from 1940 to 65, they create 26 new parishes as well. So this is an incredible administrative feat. And so within all of that, I was interested in what role did he take in the design of churches, and why did churches look the way they did? I suppose there is the story in terms of the built-in evidence. So there's this extent of these new churches, which are vast, mass concrete sheds, which are dressed up or clad in different kind of historicist or revivalist styles. A little bit of Byzantine here, a little bit of neo-Romanesque there. And it's kind of build them big and they will come, make towers. And so trying to figure out in the correspondence, how much influence did Archbishop McQuaid have? And then the other line of inquiry was the folklore, the anecdote that I had received from the older generation of architects, who were really wounded when I came to this research about 20 years ago. They were really wounded by a series of events, one from the 50s, the Clonsky Church competition from 1954, which is a huge Byzantine church in Bird Avenue. And there had been a competition. The whole architectural community threw in designs. Everyone was really excited. They might eventually get to change Irish Catholic design. And so the competition went really well. It cost the diocese about £3,000. It was very expensive. And at the last minute, having awarded the prizes to a series of younger designers mostly, the Archbishop came in and threw the whole competition in the bin, effectively, and chose a non-commended design by the firm Jones and Kelly, very traditional design, and that building was built. So the architects, a lot of them left the church at that point. They were just so disillusioned. So I was interested in this whole discussion. I think Cooney marks it too, that Archbishop McQuaid was markedly anti-modernist, and that he took a lot of he controlled an awful lot of, say, the glass, the statues, all those kind of adjacent pieces in church design. And in that inquiry, I discovered that he was actually really only interested in church design and form very peripherally. Really, what he seems to have been doing more than anything was trying to organize schools, because that was the church's mission. And education seems to have been his thing from the outset. And actually, churches were almost something of a monumental distraction. And I mean monumental literally and figuratively. And so over and over again, what he seems to be doing with his advisors is mapping out where schools should go. And so in a chicken and egg fashion, I was trying to find out what was his relationship with Dublin Corporation, for instance. Again, anecdotally, I'd heard that Michael O'Brien, the town planning officer, would visit McQuaid every week in Clonliffe and share the plans of the corporation. And I wanted to know, was that true, and who was influencing who? So it does seem that actually the infrastructural changes were happening. Michael O'Brien, in other words, were the corporation was acquiring land and carrying out big engineering works like, say, the Hoth drainage scheme in the early 50s, and then going to McQuaid and his advisors and saying, look, we're about to develop all of this, so we're going to have swathes of housing. We need you, because we can't afford to do it and the state can't afford to do it, we need you then to provide the churches, the pastoral infrastructure. If we provide the sewage, the lighting, the drainage and the houses, we need you to come in with that final piece. And in so doing, it becomes a big game, actually, of social engineering. And so those estates, then you can begin to map who comes in and who does what. So the houses, the state acquires the land and develops and then invites the church to come in and to kind of fill the massive social gaps. So I think it was interesting to see that chicken and egg situation.
So Ellen, in your opinion, what was the end result? I mean, how does Charles McQuaid stack up as a planner? I'll come back to the architecture in a second, but on the planning, like, was he any good as a planner?
Well, I don't think he really is the planner. I think he's responding to the planner, with the planner being, say, the town planning officer and that whole team, and say Hernan and the city manager. But where he does come in, when the housing is laid out, and construction is in train, at that point he is brought in the whole time, actually really regularly, and is really quite disruptive to the architects as to where the schools and church will be placed. And he consistently is an obstacle to what, say, sometimes the architect wants to do, where he wants to go with certain services, like, for instance, playing fields, etc., because they will have to be placed near these large kind of structures of public authority, the churches. So, I mean, it's all about visibility for the church, and then the schools come in alongside the church, or the schools come first and then the church. Certainly as the parishes, from what I can tell, the more needy the parishes. For instance, Finglas West is evolving in the mid-60s, late-60s, and then later on, a decade later, well, no, a bit later, Ballymun. The schools are all there first, and the schools allow the priest to use their hall at the weekends for extra masses. So the school, it's all schools, and increasingly through his mission, it's schools, schools, schools. And by the end of his time, the archdiocese is in dire financial straits, which is why then he kind of manhandles the finances in the likes of Finglas West and the likes of Ballymun, and he introduces this thing called planned giving. And he tries to get the wealthier parishes like Donnybrook and Navan Road to do it, and they go crazy, and they're absolutely not. We are autonomous. We know how to fundraise. And by doing planned giving, he's getting these British fundraising consultants to come in and to manage the envelopes in the door, and it becomes completely streamlined away from your raffles and all of that, and something much more streamlined. So as a planner, I'm not sure. Like he's responding, Tommy, rather than. He's responding on the one hand to what the corporation are doing, but then when it comes to the fine grain, he's dictating. It's a very strange to-ing and fro-ing.
Now, just on the architecture, right? Because from what you're saying, you're talking about these large, you know, concrete structures. I get the impression that you're not that impressed by the architectural quality of them, you know, many of these churches. I mean, just to say my own experience, I moved to Dublin when I was 11 to Rathfarnham, and the local church there in Ballyroan was Church of the Holy Spirit, built in the 60s. Now, I think it's a beautiful building, actually. It's one of the better ones. So there are the odd gems here and there, but in general,
yes,
I would take your point. Well, large kind of sheds, really, many of them, you know.
Well, you're actually talking about two different periods, would you believe, in the nuance of post-World War II church architecture. So you've got all the stuff that McQuaid and Bishop Lucy and Bishop Brown are overseeing, which are historicist or revivalist buildings. Yeah, they're modernist, maybe in their fabric, as in their concrete. They're huge volumes, but they're dressed up in historical clothing. But then by the mid 60s, the ideas are trickling down from Vatican II, which is a transnational liturgical and spatial supposedly revolution for the church. Now, the hierarchy in Ireland are resistant to a lot of Vatican II, and they are resistant to architectural transformation, which is happening elsewhere, as Brian's saying, what's happening with different reform in France and Germany. And there's resistance to that trickling down to church form through the 60s. And the architects are pushing for it, as are some of the orders like the Jesuits, working with architects like, say, Andy Devan and others, Liam McCormack, who you may have heard of, the amazing churches in Donegal. So they're pushing for it from the inside out, but McQuaid is really resistant. And by the end of the 1960s, he can't really resist anymore, because there's a committee that are very influential, that are made up of architects and others. And you have characters like Austin Flannery, who are all trying to radicalize the church from the inside, from a liturgical perspective. So you get a bunch of churches bit by bit from the late 1960s. So the church, the first church that's legitimately post-Vatican II is the Church of Dublin Airport, Queen of Heaven, which is an amazing church by Andy Devan. And then but through the 70s, these churches are growing up like Ballyroan, etc. Now, he's finished by the early 70s, and he leaves a diocese in an absolute in a ruinous state financially. And in a large part, that's as a result of this extreme expansion. So, as I say, there's 34 churches built through this time. And in the 1960s alone, across the whole of Ireland, there are 30 churches built per year. So this is expansion writ large, you know, on steroids, really, in terms of what's going on. So there isn't as much quality control as we'd like.
Okay, I tell you what, I want to go back to David McCullough here. David, just back to the 1940s, right? And talk to us about the National School Teacher Strike, right? Because McQuaid was quite sympathetic to the teachers, as I understand it. And this, of course, led to a further cooling of his relations with Dev.
Yeah, he certainly was. He wanted the teachers, he supported the teachers' demand for a living, a Christian wage, I think is what he described to us. And he sought to intervene in the strike and helped to broker a solution. And this obviously didn't go down too well with De Valera. And as you say, it marks another cooling in the relationship. So they're really, at this stage, they're really quite estranged. McQuaid is still bitter about the failure to, as he saw, recognize the position of the Catholic Church in the Constitution. The two men would have been, both of them, I suppose, quite touchy when it came to questions of precedence and stature and who should approach whom over issues and stuff like that. McQuaid had a big row with De Valera about the Commission on Youth Unemployment, which he'd been asked to chair, and the government wanted to appoint a couple of Protestants, including, I think, the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Dublin, onto the commission, and McQuaid refused. And De Valera said that if you excluded Protestants, you'd leave the government open to accusations of discrimination. And McQuaid argued that this couldn't be so because even what he saw as the faulty constitution recognised the Catholic Church's special position. So the two men are at loggerheads. And when De Valera loses office in 1948, McQuaid goes so far as to say to Lord Rugby, the British representative in Dublin, that the country was glad to see the back of De Valera. So there you go, not a very happy relationship.
And David, would it be true to say then that the reason why McQuaid didn't get the red hat, didn't become a cardinal, was because of opposition from Dev, or is that just speculation?
Well, I'm not sure that there was necessarily opposition, organised opposition. There was certainly no enthusiasm in government circles to push for it. And there's an exchange of messages between De Valera and Joseph Walsh, who had been appointed Irish ambassador to the Vatican in 1946. And Walsh says Vatican officials are saying that, in fact, the Pope, I think, were saying that I was going to make Dublin a cardinal, but the Americans were opposed to it. I yielded because, after all, they are the same as yourselves. And Walsh thought this meant that the Americans had cleared the pitch on McQuaid, and De Valera replied and he said he thought it was probably just that the Americans were trying to get an extra cardinal position for themselves and managed to persuade the Vatican that there wasn't much difference between an Irish cardinal and an Irish-American cardinal. But in any event, Dublin was certainly not making, De Valera was certainly not making any efforts to support McQuaid's being made a cardinal. Certainly no push being in as there was to get him made Archbishop of Dublin some years previously.
Now, David, what were McQuaid's relations with other politicians? I'm thinking about John A. Costello, Sean McBride, and of course we'll get on to Noel Brown. So how did that contrast with his relationship with Dev?
Well, Costello was a different kettle of fish. Costello was extraordinarily obsequious to McQuaid. Shortly after he became Taoiseach, there was McQuaid invited him to a special mass to celebrate the anniversary of the Pope's coronation. And Costello wrote, "I accept the invitation, as I am sure will each member of the government to whom I will have it immediately conveyed." The next year, he said a similar invitation acceptance was not merely our duty, but a privilege. And he was very, very deferential to McQuaid, partly because of McQuaid's position, partly because Jack Costello was a very devoted Catholic and regarded regarded McQuaid as the most important representative of the church in Ireland and treated him as such. McBride was also extremely obsequious, perhaps less out of genuine devotion to the church and more out of political calculation that you didn't want to get on the wrong side of John Charles, and he made every effort to suck up to him on every available opportunity. Brown, as you say, was a different kettle of fish again. He was not as obsequious, but he was still somewhat obsequious. And you know, we'll probably talk about the mother and child affair in a moment. But at the end of that, in the Dáil, Brown bowed the knee like the rest and said he, of course, accepts the decision of the hierarchy as final. So I think for any politician, no matter how radical their reputation in later life might have been, for any politician in the late 1940s, going against the hierarchy on a matter of faith and morals was considered unthinkable.
Well, David, could you just say for our listeners, right, because you hear this phrase of mother and child scheme, what was the problem with this? What was the issue here? Because, I mean, it didn't just start with Noel Brown. I mean, this was being discussed by Dev's government before.
Yeah.
If you could sum it up in about 2 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll do my best. There's a lot of misconceptions about it. It's described as a church-state clash or conflict. There wasn't really much conflict when it got down to it. Once the bishops ruled, that was the end of it. And it was also much wider than a church and a matter between church and state. The idea was to introduce free medical care for children up to mothers and children up to the age of 16. The doctors didn't like it, obviously, because it threatened their financial interests, and the medical profession was very good at dressing up concerns about their financial position with wider issues. I'm sure it wouldn't happen today. But basically, some of the doctors managed to persuade the bishops that this was a step towards socialized medicine, that this would be a bad thing, that the state could start interfering within the family, that the state might introduce contraception or, God forbid, abortion under this scheme. So the bishops got riled up about it, and McQuaid led the opposition. When Brown approached the bishops with his outline of the scheme, McQuaid and his colleagues were not happy about it. They wrote to the Taoiseach, John A. Costello. The Taoiseach got involved. And it's very interesting that Costello said to John Charles McQuaid at one point that he was worried that Noel Brown was going to resign from government, that he was going to use the mother and child scheme as the excuse, and that he would split apart Clan na Publicta, the political party to which he belonged, and the government. And therefore, according to McQuaid's account at the time, Costello said what he was going to do was he was going to get Brown to submit the scheme to the hierarchy and then await their ruling. And he clearly felt that if he did this, Brown wouldn't be able to resign from government with the mother and child scheme as a reason to rally public opposition because the bishops would have ruled against it. So obviously McQuaid was using Costello, but Costello, to an extent at least, was using McQuaid. So you have the opposition of the doctors, you have splits within the government. Fine Gael was opposed to the mother and child scheme because it would damage private practice and damage the interests of people who, by and large, were good Fine Gael supporters. So even when eventually the bishops came around to support a revised scheme when De Valera got back into power, Fine Gael still opposed it. So the Fine Gael opposition and the medical opposition to the mother and child scheme was not because the hierarchy were against it. It was more the other way around.
Now, one of the problems with this, it seems to me, is that Noel Brown has been sort of retrospectively canonized as a sort of a secular saint. But, I mean, did he handle it badly?
Yes. He handled it extremely badly. And in fairness to him, this was, you know, he was a very young man. He was in his first term as a TD. And he was appointed straight into cabinet. So he wasn't as cute, perhaps, as some of the others. And he wasn't prepared to compromise. And he, right the way throughout the dispute, regarded his main enemy as the doctors. And he didn't realise that the doctors' rallying of the hierarchy behind them and medical profession's influence on the upper reaches of Fine Gael were just as dangerous. So he spent all his time battling the doctors, didn't really see the danger of these other factors. And he rushed ahead without having full cabinet approval for the introduction of the scheme. The legislation had been approved by cabinet, but he hadn't got a full discussion at cabinet of the actual detail of the scheme. So therefore, when he published it, they were able to disown it. And Costello in particular made his officials go back through the files and make sure that he had a reason to disown it. So basically he published his scheme. The government colleagues wouldn't back it. The hierarchy came out against it. And basically he was left with no option but to resign. And the fact that that opposition was so strong and conclusive kind of undermined his other objective, which was to try and split Clann na Publiota and remove Sean McBride as leader. So there's all these different events coming together, these different streams of opposition coming together. McQuaid played a very important part in it, but he wasn't the only factor, and people sometimes forget that.
Now, you see, one of the things that comes up here was that the whole issue of subsidiarity, you know, that render unto Caesar or the Caesars and so on. But it seems to me this is in stark contrast to McQuaid's own hyper-interventionism on these social questions. And I want to bring Brian back in here on this. You know, he wasn't slow about intervening in areas which on the face would seem to be beyond his remit. For example, setting up emigrant services, Brian. Could you talk to us about that? Because, I mean, this is outside the physical jurisdiction of his diocese, or his archdiocese.
This is a very interesting aspect of what he did. Irish emigrant services were set up very much on the initiative of not only the local priests in both Birmingham and London, which were the two main centres, but very much on the initiative of McQuaid himself. And he had roots into both Irish clergy, who were working in the centres in Britain. Many of them and leading Catholic churchmen in Britain came from an Irish background. And although he had no institutional authority over them, he pressed and bullied and persuaded and organised and had Irish priests sent over to do this work, be it, for example, with emigrant advice services. They had a system of Catholic chaplains working with the Irish workers who were out building the motorways, the nuclear power stations, and so on at that time. And that was accepted in England. And I use that phrase advisedly because Scotland was a no-go area. The Scottish Catholic Church closed off themselves from Irish influence. McQuaid's writ did not run in Scotland. But the Catholic Church in Britain was very happy to accept the help, the personnel, the funding that was coming from Dublin. I think on your point on subsidiarity and so on, I would presume that Archbishop McQuaid would have agreed with that, but I am struck most by the sheer pragmatism and the evidence based for the service that he organised. He was very interested in what parish priests had to say about social conditions. He asked them about it. The Irish centres that were set up in Britain documented their work a lot, and a lot of the information about social conditions, who the Irish emigrants were, and for example, quite a number were people who were turfed out of mental hospitals and given a ticket to the boat and go over there. That is documented. The trail of documentation is very, very strong. And I think that informed a lot of his actions. He looked at the evidence, he saw it, he acted on it. And just at a personal way, we hear the stories of the clergy who were summoned to Archbishop's House in Drumcondra in a state of terror, often leaving in a similar state. But no homeless man or destitute person ever went there without getting an audience and being sent away, felt that he'd been given some kind of help from him. So I think his approach was very much rooted in pragmatism and the on-the-ground experience from which I suspect governments could learn to this present day.
Okay, tell you what, I want to go back to Mary Kenny here on this because, I mean, this what Brian and Ellen, to some extent, painted a fairly positive picture here, you know, which I think many of our listeners won't be aware of. But let's look at the some of the negatives here, right, Mary? Because you describe McQuaid in your History Ireland piece in the current issue as a control freak. What do you mean by that? Just give us some examples of that.
Well, he couldn't stand anything that wasn't within his control. I mean, David has referred earlier to, you know, his dislike of Protestant doctors. There was a terribly good doctor called Dr. Collis, who was really, really very keen on helping reform conditions in the slums and was particularly interested in tuberculosis. And he wouldn't work with, he didn't want Catholic doctors to work with Dr. Collis because of that. He wanted to be in control. And I think in that situation, somebody who was interested in health, he should have considered first the common good, which was actually to, you know, get rid of TB, which was an absolute scourge in the 1940s and up to the early 1950s. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why Noel Brown, who was our local TD actually in Sandymount, was absolutely so adored really by his constituents because he was credited with the man who got rid of TB. Of course, a lot of other people were working on it as well. So that's sort of part of the context. And during the Second World War, I mean, Frank Duff tried to start up with Leon O'Brien, who was also a very, very good person, actually. They tried to get up a little ecumenical meetings with Protestants and with Jews. And, you know, it was really important, I think, to make Irish Jews feel that they were part of the fabric of our society. And after all, De Valera had consulted the chief rabbi as well when he was drawing up the constitution, as well as the Church of Ireland and the nonconformist ministers. And, you know, Frank Duff really did try to get this a literary organisation going with people like Sean O'Fallon and Frank O'Connor, you know, who would have been quite anti-clerical. And on the other hand, also the Pillar of Fire and the Mercier associations. This is Finola Kennedy writes very well about this in her Frank Duff biography, where so that there could be dialogue. And also, I think that Jews in the 1940s in Ireland really needed to feel that sense of protection, that they were within, that they were Irish and that they were within an Irish state which would protect them. And he disbanded these organisations and wouldn't hear of any dissent. And I feel, you know, that was a very damaging thing to the sort of fabric of Irish ideas and discourse and ecumenism as well. So he had
Can I just come in there? I'll just take this a little bit further. I mean, was McQuaid an anti-Semite? I mean, we talked about his anti-Protestant sectarianism, but was he anti-Semitic? And this is a serious issue given the context of the time, but, you know, this is just in the wake of the Holocaust and so on.
It is very difficult to talk about anti-Semitism before the Second World War, because, to be honest, it's in so many texts in a casual way. I mean, it's in Agatha Christie, who's right now being, her work is being sort of cleaned up to get rid of the casual anti-Semitism, which is in her detective stories. It was in George Orwell. You know, it's in Evelyn Waugh. It's in a lot of texts this casual anti-Semitism. And in that sense, you have to realize that this was a very, very most regrettable part of culture at the time. He did talk about Jews as being opposed to the Catholic Church. He picked this up, I think, very much from his French side, because there was quite a strong anti-Semitic tradition in France, where right from the Dreyfus case and previous to that as well, that Jews were had a destructive attitude to Catholic culture. And I suppose some secular left-wing Jews were involved in things like the secularization of France. So there had been a bit of a culture war previously from the late 19th century onwards. And so that was all a part of it. But so he did. But I suppose he was equally critical of Jews and Protestants, to be fair to him, in that sense, because he absolutely focused on the Catholic Church as being the dominant one.
So you're saying he's ecumenical in his prejudices, right? Listen, Mary, I'm looking at the time here, right, because I have to bring this up right in any discussion, and this whole question of clerical sexual abuse. Now, a lot of this was uncovered years after John Charles, but to what extent, does he bear some responsibility for the culture of the Diocese of Dublin? And in a sense, the fact that he was able to expand it quantitatively meant that when this problem was revealed, it was quantitatively bigger in the Dublin Diocese simply because of its very size. So, first of all, I mean, should we give any credence to accusations of sexual abuse laid at him personally? I mean, that this is an implication in John Cooney's book. I mean, yes. Has that been shot down by most scholars at this stage? But even, that's one thing. But moving on to the other thing, his responsibility as Archbishop. So where do you stand on that?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very vast subject, which people, better scholars than I, can sum up. I mean, he was obviously a person of his time and had also accepted many of the norms of that time. But I think one of the things that I think is very regrettable is that he was opposed to adoption, to legalized adoption. And that was proposed in Ireland in 1944, because other neighboring countries, I mean, England and Wales in 1926 and Northern Ireland in 1931, introduced legalized adoption so that children who were in orphanages, as it were, children who were without families, and children indeed born out of wedlock, could be legally adopted. John Charles stood against this. Now, partly this goes back again to his mother a little bit, I think, because and this almost becomes very a very progressive view of his, that he was opposed to the separation of the natural mother and the child. And this is a view that is now taken up very much by feminists today. But on the other hand, I think the fact that he had influence in opposing adoption meant that there were many more babies who were, if you like, trafficked in a kind of black market situation, because there was a huge number of babies who were abandoned, if you like, or maybe their poor families couldn't raise them for a number of reasons. And there was a huge number of Americans, particularly, who wanted to adopt children. I mean, Paul Jude Redmond, who's very critical of the Irish adoption situation, says that there were 20 American families for every single available Irish infant available for adoption. So, I mean, obviously there was a need to address that situation in some way. And it's a very complex situation, and it's a very hurtful subject for a great many people. But I think it is regrettable that he had that power. It should have gone through the proper legislators to address. But of course, as Brian said, the Irish governments were very loath, in a way, to address sort of personal issues like this. And even the debates in the Dáil were very, very uncomfortable around the whole subjects like adoption, and when it did eventually pass in 1952.
Now, I'm looking at the clock here. We'll have to wind up shortly. Can I just ask one question? Maybe to you, David. Like, has the influence of John Charles been exaggerated? I'm thinking here about the Yugoslavia soccer game in 1955, right, which John Charles issued a fatwa against, you know. But Daily Mount was packed out. People went anyway. Any comment there, David, on that?
Well, yeah, the president didn't get to go, though, did he? Sean T was effectively banned from going by McQuaid's intervention. I think you could probably claim that his influence has been somewhat exaggerated, but there is no doubt that he had an amount of power, and he had an amount of power over politicians. He had an amount of power over what governments did. It's noticeable that any time a minister was looking to do something that they thought might be slightly problematic from the hierarchy's point of view, they went to McQuaid first, and they tried to get McQuaid on side because they felt once McQuaid was on side, the rest of them would fall into line, and they were by and large right. So he did have an amount of influence, particularly in stopping things being done, that was pretty much unprecedented. And certainly the mother and child thing, which he himself regarded as his crowning achievement. He said it was the most important event in Irish history since Catholic emancipation in 1829. Now, in fairness, he was talking to the papal nuncio, so he was obviously trying to blow his own trumpet.
But David, can I come in there on that, right? I mean, can the argument be made that the exact opposite is the case? In other words, that they almost like the folkloric remembrance of the mother and child scheme, you know what I mean? As Noel Brown done down by this overbearing cleric, that narrative has won out.
It has, but I think what's more interesting is that while McQuaid regarded it as a victory, I think in the long term it was a pyrrhic victory at best, that it actually undermined the position of the church with the public eventually. It took a while. As you say, this legend of Noel Brown facing up to the bishops and being beaten down by them and all that actually was a bad thing for the Catholic Church in the long term, and certainly a bad thing for the influence of the Catholic Church in the long time. So in the long term. So I think what McQuaid regarded in politics as his greatest achievement turned out to be something of a disaster in the long term for the influence of the church, because in future, governments were going to be very reluctant to be seen to be bowing the knee to bishops over issues over which they didn't really have any legitimate interest.
Now, in terms of legacy, Brian, if I move on to you, like in the welfare area, so what is McQuaid's legacy?
I think we're left with Archbishop McQuaid as a man of contradictions. I think what Mary has just explained about his response to broader issues of social policy like adoption and so on, he was certainly backward, arguably very cruel in his approach, anti-ecumenical before ecumenism could even get started. I think there's a legacy of 1951, which is that we still don't have a national health service. And that was one of the long-term impacts of that. At the same time, the point that I would make is that if we look at the social services, that small part of social policy, a distinct but small part of it, he was actually very progressive and set down a lot of lessons which could be well followed to the present day. Just to give you a small example, the way in which he documented, or his clergy and the centres he set up documented poverty, who were the most excluded from what they suffered, looking at what could be the solutions way back in the 1940s, contrasts with the way in which in 2009 the government agency against poverty, the Combat Poverty Agency, was actually abolished. So in some ways, in the area of documentation, all up integrated responses to social services, I think we still have a lot to learn, and that contradiction is part of his legacy.
Ellen, I give the final word to you, because in many ways the architectural planning legacy is the most enduring. So how would you sum up John Charles' effect on the city?
Yes, well, it is the most enduring. But what we're witnessing right now is the potential demolition or a demolition rally of a whole swathe of churches. If you're to look at what the Archdiocese is doing in relation to Dublin draft development plan and trying to figure out different shifting from different zoning laws, etc. So from cultural community use of church lands to residential and so on. So it's a really thorny issue. The legacy is, I suppose, very much like what Brian's saying and Mary, it's contradictory. If you look at a whole environment like Ballymun, you would see, for instance, is this something that he would have supported, this tower block housing? But indeed, I could find absolutely no instance of him objecting to those tower blocks, because that type of housing was enabling people. So while everything is done with a charitable bent and extremely pragmatic, on the other hand, he enables things to still happen. But the biggest issue, I suppose, is that he's left a legacy of all of these primary schools that are in use today, and oversaw the building of an incredible amount when we see how few are being built at the moment. And then the single biggest issue in terms of carbon and the environment are these massive, underused, so out of scale buildings, which are lying fairly empty, scattered across the archdiocese, and what to do with them. Do we maintain them as sites of reflection, as places of prayer, or can we bring them to an extended use in terms of different pastoral or community use? So he would have very much encouraged the making of those buildings, and you might say influenced the form of those buildings. And now we are in a very, I suppose, in terms of socio-cultural obsolescence, we're in a very different Ireland that would have built those buildings.
Do you think then it was a mistake in retrospect that he didn't put his chips on building a cathedral? I mean, was there a plan to build a cathedral? You know, the argument is he put the resources into building these churches in the parish.
Yeah, well, he seems to have been really focused on building all of these churches for these new worker estates, and seemed to have been very focused on the pro-cathedral as a site for whatever might happen in the city centre. Found very little after Walsh in Ormond Quay at the site of the Four Courts, Bishop Walsh, and then Archbishop Byrne and Merrion Square. I found very little conclusive evidence or conversation around what he was trying to do. It seems to have been expansion at the edge, and I think very much the idea was the suburbia, which was somehow this incohate in between territory, between the city and kind of the distractions, the moral deprivations of the city, and then the potential of the suburb as this in between site between rural and urban. He seems to have been pushing his kind of pastoral energies into that territory.
Okay, listen, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. I'd just like to thank our panel here this morning, Brian Harvey, Mary Kenny, David McCullough, and Ellen Rowley. Now, our next Hedge School will be a live one on Saturday, the 13th of May, 2:30 in Glasnevin Cemetery Museum. And we'll be looking at, you know, how the Civil War was memorialised. And that would be part of the FizzFest programme. That's the Fidsborough Community Arts Festival. So, listeners, I hope you'll be able to tune in for that. Thank you very much.